Awesome to welcome Damon University head basketball coach Mike McDonald to the basketball podcast. McDonald has been roaming Cylons for the last 36 years, all within Western New York. With previous stops at Canisius and Medina University, McDonald has worked across all three NCAA divisions. McDonald is entering his 29th season as a collegiate head coach. He was named the ECC, NABC District, and BKNE Division II Coach of the Year after leading Damon to a 28-1 record. He was also the recipient of the Clarence Big House Gaines Award given to the top coach in all of Division II basketball by collegeinsiders.com. McDonald has led Damon to a 232-84 record over his first 11 seasons, including 8 20-win seasons and 5 NCAA tournament berths. He enters the regular season just 11 wins shy of 500 for his career. McDonald led Damon University through one of the most successful stretches in program history. Under his leadership, Damon has emerged as a power in NCAA Division II basketball. Off last year's season, before arriving at Damon University, McDonald spent 8 transformative years as head coach at Medina College, where he turned a struggling NCAA Division III program into a regional powerhouse. Prior to Medina, McDonald spent 18 years at Canisius College, including 9 seasons as a head coach, where he guided the Golden Griffins to 108 wins and earned BKNE Division I Co-Coach of the Year honors in 2000 and 2001. He also served as a longtime assistant at Canisius, helping the program reach the NCAA tournament and 2 NIT appearances under head coach John Beilein.
Hey, coach, a brief time out from the podcast to bring you the Analytics Minute, sponsored by Hoopsalytics. Do you know which players should be taking what kind of shots? An analytics system like Hoopsalytics can help your team make better shot selection decisions. You can track every kind of shot each player takes, where the shots come from, rate the shot quality, track if the shot was contested, and see the results. For example, see which players are taking mid-range floaters and measure the results versus catch-and-shoot jumpers. As an added bonus, Hoopsalytics shot charts are fully interactive, so you can filter by shot distance, shot type, or even specific areas of the floor. Then watch video clips of all those shots or see the points per shot. Hoopsalytics brings the most powerful analytics to teams of all levels. It's easy to use and affordable. It's like AI for basketball coaches. Visit hoopsalytics.com/ball today. That's hoopsalytics.com/ball. Today to learn more and start analyzing your game for free.
Coach McDonald, welcome to the basketball podcast.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to talk to you. And very few coaches I've ever talked to on the podcast that have coached at all three levels of college basketball and obviously had success at all three levels as well.
Well, there aren't many of us around, I don't think. I don't know. But I've been very fortunate. I always say, I use the term, I kind of coach backwards in that I was a Division I head coach at 30. I was fired from being a Division I head coach at by 40. And then I got to a chance to be a Division III head coach for 8 years at Medina College, and that was outstanding. And then I was lucky enough to get the job at Damon College, which is now Damon University, back in 2014. So I've seen it all. I've been at all levels, and in the end, it's still coaching basketball, and that's what I really enjoy.
I've been to Damon College back in my days in Ontario, and I know where you coach there. And that's an incredible job to be able to turn that program into a Division II powerhouse, isn't it?
We've been very fortunate. We took over when we got here. Damon was transitioning, and I replaced a guy, Don Silveri, who'd been a long time, extremely successful head coach. And they had been at NAIA for years, and it was just, it was in the transition phase. So it was our last year. My first year was our last year of transitioning, where we played a conference schedule, but we couldn't play. We weren't eligible for the NCAA tournament. And we actually won a national championship of the USCAA, which was great for our guys because they had been to the USCAA back-to-back years and hadn't been able to win it. And we got a chance to win it that last year. And it was really rewarding for that to see them achieve a goal, which they wanted to do, and a lot of fun. But since then, we've been lucky. We've had some really good players here, and we've been able to build it up and be able to compete at the Division II level and a national level.
What's kept you in coaching for so long, Coach? It's been quite the career.
I don't know what else I'd do. I think male model was off the charts right away, and I didn't know what else I could do. You know what, Chris? I love coaching. And when I got let go at Canisius, I was there for 18 years, 9 as an assistant, 9 as a head coach. I remember when you were a camp worker back in the day. When I got let go, I had some other opportunities outside of coaching, maybe some administration, even totally out of basketball. But in the end, I think probably my, I want to say ego, I guess, was wanting to prove that I could coach. I thought I could coach, and I got the opportunity. Pete Lonergan, who was a former coach and athletic director at Niagara University for the men. Pete was the athletic director at Medi College at the time. He was also the women's coach. And Pete said, why don't you come over here and take this job? And he had some people, Tom Donahoe, who was a former president of the Buffalo Bills. Tom was on the board there at Medi, and he convinced me too to stay in it. And he said to me, "You're a coach. You should be coaching." And I thought, "Okay, I'm going to try and do this as best I can." And when we took over at Medi, they had been 4-46 the 2 years prior. It was quite possibly the worst job in the country. But Pete had had success in women's basketball. The soccer teams, men's and women, both had success. And I thought, why can't men's basketball be successful? So we found our niche. I had some great assistants in Gabe Michael and Todd Kane, who helped those first couple of years and helped us build it. We found just guys who were gym rats who loved to play. And it might have been the best 8 years I had coaching in my life. It was just tremendous. Just great guys who really wanted to get better. And we were able to build it up, and we were 1 point away from the Sweet 16 back in 2010. And for a school, real small school that had no success, to be within 4 years to be that close to getting the Sweet 16, it was just an amazing experience.
Awesome, and so great to have you continue coaching. And we were joking offline that you led the country in defensive field goal percentage, but that wasn't necessarily the goal in your mind, was it?
I always joke with my assistants that maybe we should start practicing defense once in a while. I never thought of myself as a defensive guru. Spent 5 years working for John Beilein and coached a big offensive guy. And I was the offensive guy on the staff when we worked together. And I've always said, hey, offense is important. But we have good defensive players, and we have guys who can guard, could guard a little bit. They bought into our philosophy, and I guess sometimes you get lucky.
Sometimes you get lucky, but I want to go down a rabbit hole of a theory here, Coach, too,
Sure.
is that you do coach offense and you do coach offense so well that ecologically your players are developing as better defenders. If they're competitive, they're bought in, all those things that you do culturally, that they're getting great reps of defense because you're playing basketball in practice and the offense is so good.
I think there's some truth there, without a doubt. I also think that we've been able to develop a philosophy over the years. The longer you do this, you know how it is. The long you develop your philosophy defensively, and you figure out who you are. And I think a couple of words of advice I always had was, one, recruit to the school, the university that you're at. Somebody gave me that a long time ago, and I think it's really true that if you can you at Damon, we can't necessarily recruit the same guys maybe we recruited at Medi, or maybe some of our competitors can recruit. And so you have to recruit to to where you are. And then you also have to figure out what you are good at and coach them to their strengths. I think I'm sitting here at my desk, and right in front of me I have a bulletin board, and one of the sayings I have that I look at every day is, the essence of leadership is designing the strengths so that weaknesses become irrelevant. And I think it's a wordy way of saying, play the guy's strengths and play to your strengths and figure out who you are, recruit to your university. And then once you have those guys, be able to coach them so that they can play the best of their abilities.
Take us through that process a little bit of playing to strengths, especially maybe we just talked about defense. Let's talk about defense. What are some strengths that help shape how you're going to emphasize certain things on defense?
I think you have to look at your team. Are you a big team? Are you a short, small team? Are you quick? Should you be playing in the passing lanes, or should you be playing more in the gaps? And I think you have to figure out the guys you have and what are they good at and where can they play. And I think, again, over time, whether it was at Canisius when we had guys get hurt and we were playing very small and we were switching everything 1 through 5, and we were able to play that at times. And then I know when we got to Medi, we tried that. And then when I got to Medi, I was coaching. We had a kid who was also on the soccer team, who came out, who was an excellent defender. I know when I was a high school coach for a while, you loved the soccer guys because they were in shape. The football guys, they're in shape in August, but they fall out of shape as the year goes on because they're not doing as much conditioning. But soccer guys are in shape the whole time. And this kid came out for our team at Medina. He was a great defender, like tremendous. And so then we decided, like, why are we switching? We want to keep, his name was Jake Reisdorf, keep Jake on the other team's best player all the time. We're not going to switch to Medina. So we're figuring out ways that we have to fight through things. So I think, again, figuring out that was different, right? That was a little bit different. And then we are not a big switching team right now at Damon, probably because of my experience at Medina and my experience with Jake Reisdorf saying, hey, you know what? Let's keep our best defender on their best offensive player and we'll figure it out.
Maybe answer the same question from the offensive end, because I think when you were coming on, I was going to talk offense most of the time anyways, but look at us going down defensive rabbit
Yeah,
hole.
let's go back to offense. I'm more
Me too.
fun.
Let's go back to
Everybody
offense.
likes to score. I'll tell you this. The strengths thing, John Beilein, I think, is one of the greatest guys ever to coach this game. He should be in the Hall of Fame in Springfield, and he will be someday. Just a tremendous coach. But one thing he always talked about, and I've tried to steal, and we do, is when you start your practice, and for high school guys who are getting ready to start pretty soon, let your guys play. Watch them play. And so often we come in, hey, this is our system, this is what we're going to do. But John was great at, hey, just letting guys play and figure out, hey, you know what? This guy really likes to drive right. So we're going to put him on the right side of the floor so he can drive baseline and attack that way. Or this guy's really good at playing off 2 feet. Maybe we'll put him on the right side because he can drive left and he's going to get in the middle of the lane and he can make plays out of there. But when you watch guys play, just pick up, just let them go. And sometimes nowadays in high school, you can do that. In college, you can do that too earlier than back in the day when I first started. It was October 15th. You couldn't do anything. Working with John, it was great to let, hey, he would just go sit up in the bleachers and guys would play and practice, take half hour of just letting them play. And I think you can learn about your guys. And I've learned that through the years too, that play a game to one. Play a quick game. 1 point, loser's got to run, loser's got to do push-up something. And then all of a sudden, they know. Like they know who they're going to get the ball to, right? Do you have a big kid who's really good? They want to throw the ball to him. Do they want to set up a guy for a jump shot? Do they want to set ball screens for their point guard who can get downhill? Because they know that game is to one. And it's even better if you have 15 guys and that team's got to come out. They can't play. And you can make it competitive that way. If you have the right mix of guys, let them play, watch them play, see what they're good at. And I think it's a simple thing, right? But so often as coaches, we want to say, this is our system. This is what we're going to do. We're going to implement this. And maybe it doesn't fit with the guys you have.
I love this. As I say to coaches, too often we predetermine what they need to learn or what they need to do without fully understanding. I'm big on the play philosophy and to start every practice with 5-on-5 to a certain extent because it informs you. But at the beginning of the year, that's a huge emphasis. I also
Yes.
know that you have really creative ways. You've mentioned games to one, which I love doing that. But maybe you have some other creative ways, which I've heard of manipulating scores or scoring in scrimmages and different things like that. So can you go give us some of those?
We do a lot of things like we'll do number one, we'll do assist games where you have to, the only baskets that count are assists. So if you play a game to five baskets, but every basket has to have an assist to really encourage passing, I think that's a good way to do it. We'll do no dribble basketball. We like that. We call it ultimate basketball based on somebody gave us a years ago about ultimate frisbee, and we just call it ultimate basketball. And we'll play a game to five, three, sometimes half court, sometimes full court. It's a great conditioner, but it's great about passing, catching, cutting, and moving, and figuring out where guys can play. We'll do things when we do drills. A lot of times, we'll maybe do a transition offense drill, and it's an offense and a defensive drill whenever you do those drills. But we'll say, hey, every offensive rebound is worth 3 points. Every turnover is minus three. So the scoring, we'll start the clock, and our poor managers, they got to get that clock to 20-20, and we'll start the score's 20-20, and now we're going to play. And so they're always on tune, and guys will be saying, hey, that was a turnover, and we might play for 10 minutes. And you're missing a layup, but you're getting the offensive rebound and putting it back in. It becomes a 5-point play. And we try and do just things like that. To again, I had an assistant coach who said once, basketball coaches are the most creative about figuring ways how to play basketball without just playing regular basketball. And it's true sometimes, but I think if you can do things like that where guys have to think whether about offensive rebounding or about taking care of the ball and not having turnovers. It'll make your team better in the long run.
It's a great way, like all those things you reference, is a great way to be able to create an emphasis without doing a drill. They're
Yeah,
learning
that's
and they're
right.
emphasizing these things within the game. So it's more representative of the game. And also, according to research, more likely to transfer to the game. So I love those concepts and those ideas. Do you do the same thing for defensive emphasis?
We do different things like that. We have a, we call it a hard hat. We have a thing we put in the basket to encourage rebounding where you can't score, right? You can't score. Some people use a smaller rim. We have one that totally blocks it out and you can't score. So we might work on our defense and our rebounding. We'll say, hey, we might play zone and we're going to play zone and we call it hard hat basketball. And the offense will get 2 points for an offensive rebound, where the defense gets 1 point for the defensive rebound, and then we go in transition. So the defense can go score at the other end, they become offense. And the other end, the hoop is regular. So now you're working on your transition offense after the other team misses it. So you're working on your blockouts, you're working on rebounding, you're working on offensive rebounding because you don't want to have to go down the court. You want to be able to run your zone offense and go down there. And then you're working on transition offense. Can we score? And then we stop it, we'll switch it. And we'll play, the other team will get to go on offense, the other team will play defense, and they'll get a chance to score. So we'll do some things creatively that way to do it. We'll do drills where you get points for stops and try and get 3 stops in a row before you can get out. So try and be creative, different things again to keep guys on their toes where you're playing basketball, but you're not just playing basketball.
Some players love it. Isn't that a big part of it as well? To gamify the game, so to speak, so that they enjoy practice?
Exactly, to make it fun and different things. Sure, we'll play game to five. Every basket's worth one. So, yes, you might have a really good 3-point shooting team, but you got to make sure that you can those threes count the same as a layup. So, what are you going to get? And we'll do a lot of those things. We'll do some. We have one of my favorites is a 4-on-3 series where we'll split the team up into groups of four, and they'll play four versus three and a half court. They'll play four versus three in a full court, and then four versus three and a half court again. And there are different ways they can score and make it difficult for them for the defense. It put the defense at a disadvantage. But for one instance, we might roll the ball out, and it's 10 seconds on the shot clock, and the offense can either get a layup or a 3-pointer. That's it. No mid-range, no pull-ups, no floaters, and they got 10 seconds to score. And so the defense has got to scramble around for 10 seconds. And I think it makes you better offensively because you got to go find a 3-point shooter. You got to drive and get a layup. You got to cut to get a layup. But it also makes you defensively better because you're scrambling around in a disadvantaged situation.
The other thing that connects for me is it's you're creating these really meaningful learning experiences. It's not always just this rote learning where they're memorizing and a drill and then they're doing the drill. They have to constantly think within those concepts that you're putting forward for them, and it really, most importantly, figure out solutions. So is that a part of the philosophy for you?
Without a doubt. I didn't intend it to be, but you realize, Chris, after years that, hey, this is what happens. Guys have to be able to think on their feet and figure something out, right? During the course of a game while they're playing. And those are your best teams, right? Your best teams are the teams where the players coach themselves. And I always joke, I'll be like, I don't even know what I'm here for. And that's fine. And I think you're better for it when they can do that.
Absolutely. And a big part of the coaching progression for us as humans as well is to be able to realize that we're not as important as we think we are in
Without
that process, isn't it?
a doubt, without a doubt. And I think it's again, I think you do a lot of the learning and the teaching and practice, and the games come, you have to be able to let them go and let them think and be able to make it. I always say the games are like exams, and you take a math class, you don't want the math professor standing above you screaming, multiply, divide. They have to be able to think for themselves at some point. You got to let them go. And I think I've learned that through the years, and you get better at it as you get older, I think.
That analogy is being adapted by me, and I'm going to share that soundbite, coach, because I could not agree more with that. And that's important for parents and coaches to understand, and to a certain extent, teammates that call for the ball all the time as well at the younger levels. So I love that.
Think too, Chris, and not to cut you off,
No, please.
when I learned this again, I was 30 years old. I was a head coach of a Division I team playing. People would say you have to be people equate coaching sometimes with somebody who's fired up, who's yelling, who's screaming, whether it's at the referees, at the players, and all that. But is that really coaching? Is that really what coaching is? Because they come to a game and they see a 2 hour snapshot, 40 minutes of game time, and they think this guy coaches because he's running up and down the sideline. And is it really coaching? And I think it's evolved through the years. I think a guy like Brad Stevens changed kind of the way people thought about it, or Jay Wright being so cool when they hit a game-winning three to win the national championship. He didn't jump up and down. He didn't run on the court. He pumped his fist, went and shook the other guy's hand. And I think that says a lot sometimes. Like, I think you have to be yourself when you're coaching. You have to be comfortable with who you are. Some people are more excited. Some people are like to run up and down. But you have to make sure that your team can respond to you, however your personality is.
Stoicism in coaching became popular thanks to Brad Stevens, which is great. But if I reflect on my knowledge of you over the years, and certainly going back to those, even the Canisius days, I always felt like you were a good role model for me. My head coach role model, Joe Razzo,
I do.
he was the complete fiery guy. And I fought that. That's who I'm supposed to be. But that's not me. And you were a good role model because I always felt like you were just this. You were genuinely yourself. And Coach Beilein, to a certain extent, was probably a good model for that as well.
Without a doubt, very always very cool under pressure, always very calm when it was able to fiery when you need to be, but also being able to point things out and say, "Hey, let's relax, let's take a deep breath." And I think, you know what? And whether you could say it's the kids have these kids having gone through COVID, whatever, kids are different nowadays, right? Kids I coach are different than the kids I coached back then. You know what happened? And it happens, I think, to everybody. Guys who I coached at Canisius or I coached them at Dive, oh, you don't yell at them anymore, or you're not as tough on them as you were on us. It's no different than my four sons. And when they say, oh, you're nicer to him now than you were back when we were growing up, it's the same thing.
It is so funny. I know we get caught in those generational things. Diving a little deeper with your offensive philosophy a little bit, maybe can you go a little bit deeper on defining and measuring kind of advantage creation in your program? Because you scored points, you had great percentages, and obviously incredible success being number one in the country. So talk to us a little bit about offense and how you were creating advantages for your
Okay.
players.
Why we were number one in the country, Chris? You know what the key was? Good players. That's what we had. We
Course.
had good players, right? And
Always.
everything. Yes. And they were good players who were incredibly unselfish and cared about the team. And when you have that, that can mix. And there's also luck mixed in, right? We were the last team to lose a game in the country. And let's be honest, that's why I'm on this thing, right? Nobody would have heard of Damon if we weren't good. If those guys weren't good players, if those guys were incredibly unselfish and just cared about the team. And they were unselfish offensively, they were unselfish defensively, which is sometimes a thing that's really overlooked. But going back to an offensive philosophy, I've been blessed in my time at Damon, just in my 11 years I've been here. We've had some really good big men, and not necessarily by design. But it's worked that way. And we've had different types of big men. When I got here, there was a guy named Gerald Beverly who just finished up playing 10 years overseas. Gerald played in the G League. He played in Japan, Israel, Italy. He was all over the map and was an excellent Division II basketball player who could have played Division I. And he was a guy who grew and got better and developed over time. And then after Gerald, we had a guy named Arif. Gerald was a very much a post-up, jump hook, jump over you, dunk on everybody, finish lobs. Think Blake Griffin type guy, right? Where then we get this guy, Reef Mametai, was our center for 2 years, who was a jump shooter. He was arguably our best 3-point shooter and was a really good shooter. And so we had to play, instead of posting a center, now you had to play a center who's going to shoot threes and run things for him to shoot threes, which was different. And then I had the incredible fortune of coaching the guy who probably was the best player in the history of Damon, Andrew Sisco. And Andrew was a true back to the basket big man who could score, had great feet, great hands. And so the point I'm getting at is I had different guys in different ways and different centers. And so you have to be able to be creative with what your guys do well. And it taught me really. again, you're always evolving, you're always learning, and it's really taught me to be able to, hey, these are guys' strengths, play to those strengths.
So, talk to us about your offensive identity then. What are the things that shape the identity of your program and your players?
I think the thing we always want to do is we want to be able to take care of the ball and we want to get good shots. And I think good shots for one team, for last year's team, might be different than good shots for this year's team, right? That's just the way it works. And I think one thing we talk about all the time is ball moves, scoreboard moves. If the ball moves, the scoreboard moves. And generally, that's, we talked last year that passing was our superpower. We were so unselfish. And I'm starting to see it this year as we're going through some scrimmages, exhibition games, and seeing this year we have some of those same tendencies. And I think that when you do that, man, it's tough for people to guard. Everybody says they want to play fast, right? And we're going to play fast. We play with pace, right? Everybody plays with pace nowadays. That's a new way of saying we play fast. But in the end, I think we all want to play fast. You want to go up and down, but we want to get a great shot every time down. And I think as long as we're moving, the ball is going to, it's going to, the basketball guys are going to reward you by getting a good shot. And when you take good shots, we were always a belief too that when you take a good shot, you're much more likely to get an offensive rebound, right? Because when guys take bad shots, they take quick shots, the guys aren't ready to go rebound. And I think it turns over. I always think it's all interconnected, right? That the your defense benefits when you're taking good shots too. One thing we say all the time is there's no defense for a turnover, and there's also no defense for a bad shot. And yeah, you take a bad shot when guys aren't ready to get back in transition defense, that ball comes out, they get it. You're going to find you give up transition baskets that way, just like turnovers. Obviously, you come down and you throw it right to the other team, they got a pick six, they're going the other way, they're going to score. There's no defense for that turnover. And but it's also within the flow of your offense. You make a bad decision, you make a bad turnover, you're putting your defense at a disadvantage. And the ideal thing for any team is to be back and loaded up to the ball defensively, right? What do they call it? Complementary football. Football, right? The offense takes care of the defense, defense takes care of the offense. It's the same in basketball. You got to be able to be complementary and help each, help the other end of the floor out.
No, I love that example of the synergy between the two.
Hey, coach, a brief interruption of our podcast. You know the best player development is coaching development. So let's work together to get your entire basketball organization or program unparalleled expertise and access to Basketball Immersion's group memberships. It's affordable and your players will thank you. Contact us today, basketballimmersion.com. Contact page or DM us on X or Instagram. Get your coaches full access to our extensive coaching video library, detailed courses, and modern evidence-based coaching ideas. You can have proven coach development at your fingertips for all of your coaches. Elevate your coaches, elevate your teams, get started now. Basketball Immersion Group membership is where innovation meets excellence. Contact us today at basketballimmersion.com, contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Now back to the podcast.
And circling back to what you said at the beginning about watching your team at the beginning of the year, you mentioned having an exhibition already, two of them, if I remember right.
We've had two scrimmages and an exhibition already. It's
Yeah,
quick.
two scrimmages and an exhibition. Take us through this process then. So you've obviously built the team up to be able to play in these games. What is the process after these games? Do you use those games to a certain amount to be able to evaluate and see what you've got to do more? Or are you using those as dress rehearsals for your first game?
Little both, depending on how fast you have a turnaround until your next game. I think you watch like when you look at the stats, all of a sudden you see maybe 12 guys are playing in the rotation. It's tough to play 12 guys in a regular game, but you're getting guys in, giving them a chance to play, seeing how they do, and then I think also figuring out, hey, what are we good at? What can we be better at? We're good. We like to challenge our guys with the scrimmages. Maybe we try and play Division One teams and play teams who are better than us. We try and play good teams because even if we lose, it's not going to be the end of the world. It's going to be something like at the end, we're 0-0, and here's where we start. And now, when our first game comes up, that's when it's really going to matter.
So, with that philosophy, then, what are you doing now? You're getting ready for your first official game coming up. What does
Yep.
this process look like this week? Because I think, again, we talk about preseason as building up to your first exhibition, your first game, but I think one of the most important points for college coaches is this Just time in between. You just played your exhibition, your scrimmage, and now you're getting ready for your first game.
So we've had some film work, say, hey, this is what we did, let's we gotta do better. Now we start to say, all right, let's start to narrow down the rotation a little bit, figure out who we are and how we're gonna play. And I think that's ever evolving too. I think it's gonna evolve through some of your non-conference games, especially for us. We're starting early this year. We're playing November 1st, which is early. And we play November 1st and 2nd. We got invited to the National Small College Hall of Fame Classic down in Florida, which is John McCarthy puts it on. It's a great event. And we're going to play really good teams. And that's okay. You can't go in there being afraid to be coming out being 0-2, because in the end, you're going to get better for it. You're going to be better. You're going to learn from it. So you can't be afraid to play some good teams. And then we have 12 days off before our home opener. So for us, it's going to be like, you know what? We'll have some time to reset even after this weekend. But we'll use this weekend to develop ourselves and see. And we have a couple of guys who are still coming back from injury, and we'll learn. But you can't be afraid to challenge a team early. And I think that's what we're trying to do with this year's schedule, is we're really challenging.
Based on that, then, what are some of the things that have helped sustain your program? You built it, obviously you had some early success too at the as your school, as you said, transitioned, but now you're in this point where, again, number one in the country, and now you're building and trying to sustain it. So what are
That
some of
was
those key
last year.
factors?
That was last year. The whole
I
new year.
know, I get you, coach. I know you're a coach and we're going to
Yeah.
dismiss it, but damn, it's a lot of work to get there, and a lot of great players have contributed to that. And now, obviously, you've
And great
tasted it, they've
assistant
tasted it. We want to
coaches,
sustain it.
and great assistant coaches, great trainers, great managers, all those things who help you. So yeah, so trying to sustain is sometimes the toughest thing. And I think the biggest thing we talk about all the time is step by step. Like, you can't skip steps. I think it's so much in life, right? And I always use the example. I was a graduate assistant. I became a full-time assistant coach. Then I became the top assistant. Then I became the head coach, all at the same school. But it's a progression. And I think coaching is a progression. We've lost that a little bit right now with the transfer portal, with guys leaving. And I'm not good or bad, whatever. It's just guys go for a year and with the idea that I'm going to go somewhere else. And you lose that progression of, hey, I'm going to get better. I'm going to be here. And each year, my role is going to expand and I'm going to get a little bit better. And I was brought up on that, right? With just as I was brought up in this business by the people who hired me, the people I worked for, and as a coach, that guys would come in as a freshman, they would get some time and you become a sophomore. You're playing a little more. Maybe you're starting as a junior, you're starting, you get an expanded role, and a senior, you're the man. And it's kind of lost nowadays, right? Because everybody goes from school to school. I'm watching some of the Division I exhibition games now, and you see somebody saying he's been at this school, this school. You're counting four schools, and this is his fifth school. It's like amazing, right? And great that guys can bounce around, great that they can get a better situation for themselves and their families. But I think what's lost is a little bit of the going through the adversity, dealing with the progression of, hey, you know what? I have to come off the bench now. How am I going to handle that? And I think it's a tricky thing. It's a really tricky thing.
Is there a way to counter that, or not counter that, I guess, account
Yeah.
for that as a head coach and running your own program?
I think so. I think you hope, you talk to guys about this is it. We're very fortunate. We had 13 guys back from our team last year. Right, we have four. Our top four scorers are back from last year's team. I don't think you find that anywhere very often. I tried to challenge some people to say, see if you can find anybody else who has their top four scorers back, Division One, Division Two, or Division Three. I mean, just
Not
because
many,
at A
coach.
level, right? At A level, they want to go. And I'd like to think, Chris, it's just my bubbly personality, and they want to be around me. But I know better. I think we have a really good school, and the guys had a lot of fun playing. And I think they're okay with. You know what? I'm going to accept a role. I'm going to play in that role. And it's not always going to be that way. Last year, it was unbelievable. It was nirvana of coaching. It was like we had three seniors who just wanted to win. The John Beilein's old quote that he used to say all the time is, freshmen want to play, sophomores want to start, juniors want to score, and seniors want to win. And to get to that point where everybody is like the seniors who want to win and just will do whatever they can to win, it takes some time as a coach, and it's not only dealing collectively with a group, I think it's also dealing with them individually and having meetings with them, talking to them, understanding their role, and showing them that what you can get by excelling.
Well, I love this. And you're a coach's coach. I know that other people have referred to you as that to me as I prepared for this a little bit. You love coaching, you love the process. So with that other part of that, then should we create more adversity situations for players to be able to learn how to cope and handle some of these things that maybe they're not experiencing because they're jumping from program to program more?
Yeah, I think you have to. I think you have to get it so that they are dealing with some adversity they're dealing with when things don't go their way. And I think that's what happens, right? Everything's great when everything's going your way. Look, if we won 28 games in a row, it was easy. But it wasn't always easy. There was some adversity in there. And sometimes you have to build up some more adversity and practice and give them situations, disadvantaged situations where you're down and you have to come back, or you're playing with four people against their five people, right? All those things. And because things don't always go your way. Basketball is like life. We always like to say it as coaches, but it is, right? And we always say it's 10%, right? 10% what happens to you, 90% how you react to it. And how do you react to a bad call? How do you react to fans getting on you? How do you react when you miss a free throw? You airball a free throw. You do something bad, right? You shoot an airball. Do you laugh? Do you get upset? It's going to happen. It happens to everybody, right? I'm going to take a timeout maybe when I shouldn't take a timeout. And that happens.
Great advice for sure. On this question, coach, I'm going off the assumption a little bit that I coached a small college type of basketball experience, much like a lot of the coaches that are listening to this, high school and whatever, that we don't necessarily have as many easy touch points with players as, say, the Division I level, where a lot of the schedules are shaped around the players and their basketball experience. Can you talk a little bit about balancing the student athlete portion of this and accounting for the individual while also still giving you enough touch points to be able to help shape them as players in your program and obviously people for life?
Yeah, I think you have to remember what you're in this for, right? We all love the game of basketball if you're coaching basketball or whatever sport you coach. And we're all competitive, right? People, you ask me, why are you still doing this? Why are you doing this? And I'm like, I enjoy it, right? I enjoy the competition. I think that's it. I can't really play anymore. I never know if I ever really could play, but I enjoy the competition of coaching. I enjoy the competition, the puzzle of trying to fit a team together and put a team together. I always look at it like it's a puzzle and how can we fit that puzzle together? But I think I enjoy the relationships and the connection with people. And I think you have connections. I'm sure like you with group chats with guys that were at Canisius or guys that played for me at Madai. We have the Mavs group text and they will talk and something will pop up and usually they can make fun of me and that's fine. That's a great thing to happen. But I think all those things are those. I think if you can, as a coach, have a small part in helping guys get better as a player, but also as a person, as a student. I can't really see behind me back there, but there are pictures of everybody graduating from Damon in a cap and gown. And that to me is really special because maybe some of these guys are first generation kids. And the first one from their family to be able to get a degree. And maybe they're not going to the NBA, but maybe they've gotten a chance to better their lives by having a college degree and they can go out and get a job and be productive. And if something we've done as coaches is help them along the way, I think it's special. And I think that's what you have to remember. That's what you're getting in for. It's not the X's and O's are great. That's what I like playing with, right? When to call a timeout. Yeah, that's important, right? All that stuff is great. But in the end, the connection with people, and when you see them and you see them go out and have a job that they enjoy doing and they're part of it, I'm awed. And just by the number of guys that we've coached that have gone into coaching and that are coaching, whether it's at high school or college, whether it's guys who were managers for me at Canisius who were coaching or guys who played at Madai who were coaching. And that to me it's great. It's great to go watch their teams play and see that. And it's neat that they looked at this and they look at it and say, you know what? That's something I want to do. I don't know. It's a lot of words for that answer. The other thing I'll tell you is having four boys, some of my boys' best role models are my players, guys I've had. tell the story. I had a great player, Canisius Bryant Dukes, who ended up playing overseas and was a really good point guard. And he was coaching at camps. And Dukes was what a great kid and everything. But he would work camp, and his pants would hang down, his boxers would be out. And I still remember my oldest son, Matt, coming down for breakfast one day and having boxers on. He was probably 8, 9 years old, boxers on, hanging out of his shorts. And my wife looks at him, and I look at him. I said, "No, pull your pants up. We don't need to see your underwear." And it's the same thing. I went in and I said to Duke, "See what you did? You're his role model. Now he's walking around with his underwear hanging out because of you." And the guys loved it. They thought it was hilarious. But the great role models our guys had through the years were our players. And I was fortunate because my two oldest guys, Matt and Pat, they kind of had the Canisius guys, and that's who they knew. And my third guy, Nick, who's actually a grad assistant at the University of Cincinnati right now, basketball, he was the Madai years. He knew all those Division III guys. He knew the Madai guys. And my youngest guy, Mark, he knew the Damon guys. So they all kind of had their own little group that they were a part of. And I think that was very lucky for me as a parent, and my wife as parents, that we could have those guys that our guys could look up to.
That is very cool, and I can hear the passion in your voice about that. And having your sons around your program and around your team, that was a big part of it, I imagine.
Huge part of it. Huge part of it. Funny story. People don't remember. I was at Canisius and we were going through a bad year, whatever. Some guy wrote, this is back when you'd write letters to the editor in the paper, and he wrote a letter to the Buffalo paper complaining because we had, yeah, I had probably my two oldest sons, Matt and Pat, and they probably each had a friend. So we had four kids behind the bench. They were the water boys. They would get the water for the guys. And this guy wrote, "No wonder they're losing. They got little kids behind the bench or whatever." And thankfully, my AD at the time, Bill Maher, stuck up for me and wrote the guy, called the guy, found the guy's number and called him and said, "That's the most ridiculous thing ever. You're really going to say that they can't have kids behind the bench? What are you thinking?" But I learned that. I learned that obviously from my parents about trying to be a good parent. But so John Beilein was great at having his kids involved at our practices and things like that when he was a head coach. And I always said, "That's what I want to do." So I've been fortunate that my guys have all been water boys. They've all been part of the program, and they got a chance to be on the road trips, go in the locker room, maybe hear their dad say a bad word every now and then, and been told, "Don't repeat that when you get home." But they got a chance to be a part of the program. And what I think is cool is our guys who played, now they're like, "Wait a minute, he's playing in college now." So my youngest guy, Mark, was one of the Damon guys, and they're like, "Wait a minute, he's playing in college now? That's crazy." And that's fun that they through the years they saw Matt and Pat with the Canisius guys, they knew them, Nick with the Madai guys, and then now Mark with the Damon guys. They all had their own fan club, if you will.
Full circle indeed. And one of the parts that sticks out for me is that, like, my daughters, two daughters as well, they came to everything I could possibly bring them to, whether they were at practice running around the gym or they were at practice and they were sitting watching, which was very rare. But I do think about some of those road trips, particularly they went on, that they saw a real human side of me that maybe otherwise they wouldn't have seen as much. Like the vulnerability of being obviously a human being with other human beings, winning and losing and the ups and downs. And it gave me great references to be able to constantly talk to them about that. That's life. We're not always happy. And we've got
That's
to
right.
learn to deal with these other things. And isn't that coaching to a T?
Without a doubt, without it's coaching, it's also parenting, right?
Absolutely. No question. And obviously, it's got to be special for you to have a few kids in coaching as well. And is that partly a little bit of satisfaction for you to be able to watch their careers and see how they evolve in this sport?
I always joke that it's like when people go into coaching because they're not smart enough to do anything else. I got to change that joke because my kids, Nick wants to get into coaching. I think Mark says he wants to get into coaching. So, yeah, if they want to get into coaching, I think it's great. I think what's kind of makes me feel good is that they realized, I think, the connection that our family had with so many other kids that are really a part of our family. And they get a chance to see that. And some of the guys they keep in touch with are guys who've played for me, who are maybe now in coaching too. So I think you get that. It's a pretty cool thing.
Very special, no doubt. And take us into your mindset this year then. You've referenced so many things throughout this podcast about your program, but what are some of the keys for this year's team to climb that mountain and maybe get to that next level to help your competitiveness shine even more?
Not skipping steps is a big one right now. Is that just because you have guys back or we have some good players back that you're not going to blink your eyes and get to where you want to be? There's going to be a progression. There's going to be step by step. And let's go see how we can do. Let's get better. Let's form the identity of this year's team. Last year's team was last year's team. This is this year's team. And I've done this long enough to know that every year isn't the same. Every year there's going to be some ups and downs and you're going to have to deal with it. And if you can deal with it and you do a good job with it, you can be successful in our own right. And we can have our own form of success. Last year we were 28-1. Year before we won 25 games. And we went to the second round of the NCAA tournament. So it wasn't like we were a flash in the pan coming out of nowhere. We've been good the last few years. We've had a lot of good teams that some have gotten to their potential. Some have maybe fallen a little bit short. Some have overachieved. And we want to, each year, we want to try and be one of those teams that overachieves where we think we could be.
You referenced some of the downs, but can you take us through your process at this point in your coaching career of dealing with, say, something that was a down? How does Coach McDonald deal with that at this point?
I think you realize that, first of all, you realize guys don't want to miss shots. You don't want to have a, you don't, they don't want to play poorly. And guys, I think you want to be able to learn from things. And I think you have to take it and say, this is a learning experience and we're going to learn from it and we're going to get better. And like all of us in life, when we've made a mistake, it's how you respond to it. And if you can respond to it, then you're going to be better for having made that mistake. And we'll make some mistakes. We'll have some games. Maybe we don't play as well. But I think when you're younger, I think you tend to personalize it. Like, how can he miss that shot? What is he doing? And sometimes it's the other team was just better on that day. So you tip your hat, say, all right, we're going to learn. What can we do better? And let's move on. And I've had some good assistant coaches who've really been able to keep me grounded through the years doing that. And I think when you do that, it helps you connect with your guys and realize that, hey, look, they're human beings too. They want to win. We all want the same thing. And we're going to go from there.
I love that answer. And I'll give you an example for me of something. As a young coach, I was terrible at celebrating the small moments, right? It was like this constant intensity and this constant drive and this relentlessness, which we've got to have as a coach to a certain extent. But I realized how bad I was. And that was one of my things that if I went back, I would have said, hey, listen, take some more moments to celebrate those things. Is there something like that stands out for you in reflecting back on some of your early years of your career?
I'll tell you about it, Chris. It's snacks. Anybody who knows us knows it. We celebrate the wins and we celebrate. And I think for me personally is when I got fired at Canisius, I said, you know what? We're going to celebrate. And I always say, everybody, the expression I hate more than anything is, boy, it was an ugly win. And I say, every win is like a baby. There's no ugly babies and there's no ugly wins, right? Yeah. We're going to celebrate the win. And maybe we didn't play our best. Fine. You know what? We won. And if we won, somebody else's definition of what is a pretty win. This ain't gymnastics, right? This ain't figure skating where there's judges and they're given a score of what you got on that move. Right? It's not like that. It's a win or a loss. And if you win, you celebrate the win and you enjoy the win. And then we move on and we'll fix what we got to fix and we'll move on to the next one. And I think that's one of the things I've gotten better at through the years. I'm not going to ever be miserable after a win. I'm going to enjoy every win. And I'll be honest, last year even, there were times where I'm like, man, we only won by 16. And I'm like, what am I, an idiot? Come on, let's go. We won. And we play to a certain level. We play to a standard. I get it. But in the end, we're playing to win. And let's go play and let's have some fun. And let's see if we can accomplish the goal of winning.
That's such good advice. And I think about, even I reflect on how many times like I apologize because we didn't win the right way or win as much as we should have or something like that. And that's absolutely the wrong approach and yours is the right approach at this point. So hopefully that will inspire some people that are maybe in the profession for the first time or even maybe having a hard time dealing with that.
Yeah, I think you have to celebrate the wins. You have to make sure everybody enjoys them. I think you have to, I get it. You want to, everybody wants to play perfect, no turnover basketball, whatever. You make every shot. That's not going to happen. And the other teams are good too. And the other teams give scholarships too. And the other teams want to win and they want to compete too. So when you win, you enjoy it. It's funny because now you see the NFL guys, you're watching football. They're all, when they win on Sunday, they have Victory Monday. And nobody's coming in Monday and Tuesday. And they all celebrate like they're little kids. And hey, if they can celebrate, we can celebrate too. Celebrate every win.
I definitely feel that I took too many things too seriously in those moments. And I think it was a Philadelphia Flyers documentary in All Access where they had a dance party after every win in the locker room. And that connected with me later in my career where I'm like, what are we doing? Yeah. And I remember Anson Dorns, obviously incredible soccer
Yep,
coach,
great
incredible
coach.
success, but their team would literally have a dance party and play music with like strobe lights before the game to get them to just relax and remind themselves they're going to win. And again, I understand not any of these are for anyone, but it just gives people perspective to be able to think differently. And I'm imagining that's something that you've done throughout your many years in coaching is that you've thought differently at different times, haven't you?
I think you evolve. I think you evolve and you figure out. But I also think each team is different, right? Just like we said, every year is different. Each team is different. Each team has its own personality. And you have to coach to that personality. Some teams might be tougher on themselves collectively as a group, while others will be very loose and you got to reel them in. And I think you have to coach to your personality. You also have to coach the team's personality.
Absolutely. And as I wrap you up, I just want you to get talk about one last thing, and that's Buffalo and that whole area that you've spent so much of your life in. And I don't know how much of the world has been to Buffalo, but I've been there so many times and I've loved all my experiences there. But just talk about how special that area has been to you.
It's home. It's home. I've lived here longer than I lived anywhere else. I grew up in Connecticut. I went to college about an hour and a half south of Buffalo at St. Bonaventure. But when I moved here in 1988, you don't think you're going to be here your whole life, but I've been very fortunate. I've been able to live. Lived in one house. I was a Division I head coach. I was a Division III head coach. And I was a Division II head coach. And I don't think many people can say that all in one house. And we were just very lucky, my wife and I. When I got fired, I had chances to move out of town, but my wife went to the same school system, school district her whole time. Her dad was actually the principal of Fredonia High School down in Fredonia, New York, just outside of Buffalo. And I grew up, I went to the same school system and lived in the same town for all my years. And we wanted to, our boys to be able to experience that too. So by not having have to move, allowing our kids to grow up and go to stay in the same town when they were from pre-K through 12th grade, we were very lucky. And it's a great place to raise a family. It's an unbelievable city. Everybody knocks Buffalo, the weather, and I say, I lived in New England, and guess what? They get snow there too. It's not like it was sunny all the time there. But the weather doesn't matter. It's the people that matter, and the people in this place are just so very special. And it's such a great city and a great place to raise a family, but a great place to live too.
Said and said throughout, Mike. I cannot thank you enough for being able to share with us and share the great career that you've had with all of us and some of the insights from that great career. So thank you so much for sharing the game with us.
Thank you, Chris. Great job for what you do. Your podcast is one of the best. It's a must listen, and people who are smart will listen to it in whatever sport they coach because I just think it's a great teaching tool. And the basketball community is better because you're doing this.
Thank you.